Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, October 18th, 2016. What's up with Julian Assange? There have been some online postings that are false, saying that there was a raid at the Ecuadorian embassy in London and he was killed. But since Saturday, when WikiLeaks lost their internet connection at the embassy, we've gotten general silence from not only Julian Assange, but a couple of his key associates. So it appears that under pressure from the U.S. government, denied by the U.S. government, and in particular John Kerry, who reportedly strong-armed the leader of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, in sidebar discussions at the recent peace talks related to Colombia and the FARC, the Indigenous Revolutionary Group. Now, I have no proof of this. I am basing this on assertions that come from Julian Assange, and they claim there are multiple American sources who have reported to them that America did pressure Ecuador to take action. Now, the Kerry group has said that Kerry, the allegation from WikiLeaks is that Kerry made the request on September 26 during a private meeting on the sidelines of the negotiations related to Colombia. Now, the State Department denies it. While our concerns about WikiLeaks are longstanding, any suggestion that Secretary Kerry or the State Department were involved in shutting down WikiLeaks is false. Reports that Secretary had conversations with Ecuadorian officials about this are simply untrue, period. Now, somewhere down the line, there will be a WikiLeaks report that will either confirm or deny the denial from the State Department. But at the moment, we'll just allow that to dangle out there. And it is suspicious in the timing. WikiLeaks had just completed the posting of the hacked John Podesta emails that included transcripts or texts of the three Goldman Sachs speeches that Hillary Clinton gave in between her gig as Secretary of State and when she publicly announced she was running for president. And those three speeches don't appear to have any real kryptonite in them, but there are embarrassments, and we'll delve into the leaked emails here shortly in our free news and comment podcast today. But what is curious is you've got to go to the Russian media outlet, the Duran, to get any current information, and they're quoting America's Associated Press. But what they tell us is that the silence is not only from Julian Assange, but also from staffers Kristen Hrafnsson. Is that how she's... There's some vowels missing here, or maybe that's just the way she spells her name. Hrafnsson. And Sarah Harrison, who's best known as the woman who was kind of the escort for... what's his name? Ed Snowden, when he was trapped in Moscow at the airport there for what seemed like months. So this is a murky and developing story. I do not want to be passing off false information or anything unduly alarming. But the other factor is that after the internet connection was lost at the embassy, Julian Assange apparently triggered the so-called dead man switch. And I've seen three tweets that went out from WikiLeaks with long strings of code. And we're given to understand that the people who know how to decode that code will be able to access a trove of documents that Julian Assange put aside in case something untoward happens to him. So this, as I said, is a developing story. We will wait and see. It's curious that the corporate media in this country is generally downplaying this story and acting like the WikiLeaks people are overreacting. And I do think that there is a concerted effort by our government in an effort to help the Hillary Clinton campaign to silence WikiLeaks, at least until the November 8th election. So I'll continue to follow this, and when I find credible information, I will share it with you here at peterbcollins.com. I am delighted at the outcome of Amy Goodman's surrender in Mandan, North Dakota, yesterday. And I was pleased that I was able to reach Colonel Ann Wright, who was on the scene. She rang off with us as she was headed into the courtroom, and it was a very brief hearing because the judge in the case simply dismissed the ridiculous and bogus charges that were initially trespass and then shifted to riot. So the charges are dismissed, and Amy Goodman left the courtroom a free woman. She offered this statement: "This is a complete vindication of my right as a journalist to cover the attack on the protesters and the public's right to know what is happening with the Dakota Access Pipeline. We will continue to report on this epic struggle of Native Americans and their non-Native allies taking on the fossil fuel industry and an increasingly militarized police in this time when climate change threatens the planet." And the advocacy group Free Press delivered nearly 25,000 petitions to the office of the North Dakota State's attorney, demanding that the authorities drop all charges against Goodman and the filmmaker Dia Schlossberg. There hasn't been any news that I've seen on the status of her case. She has been accused of various felony charges that could lead to 45 years in prison. She's the one who videotaped the protest last week, where in five different locations, activists used the shutoff valves, emergency shutoff valves, to shut down critical pipelines that bring the sludge tar sands oil from Canada into the United States. And while the action of the activists may be seen as illegal, I understand that, a journalist covering that action is not committing a crime. And somebody needs to explain the First Amendment and the legal precedents for journalists to these authorities in North Dakota. Well, it's going to grab a lot of headlines, and you're going to hear the sound bites a lot. President Obama, hosting a Rose Garden news conference with the leader of Italy, said that Donald Trump should stop whining and go try to make his case to get votes. The president: "I've never seen in my lifetime or in modern political history any presidential candidate try to discredit the elections and the election process before votes have even taken place. It's unprecedented. It happens to be based on no facts." Now, I narrowly agree with the president, as you know. The hysterical claims from Donald Trump and his allies like Rudy Giuliani that people are going to vote multiple times, including dead people, will be voting, Giuliani said, as many as eight times. It simply doesn't happen. And it is pure myth that Donald Trump is invoking. But this is the perfect opportunity for the president or other Democrats to attack what Greg Palast has revealed, the interstate cross-check list that has already scrubbed over a million people, mostly people of color. And it is based on intentionally vague data. I've explained this to you before. You know my name is Peter B. Collins. Well, they might take my registration from California and they find a guy named Peter J. Collins in Illinois or a Peter G. Collins in Dubuque, Iowa, and they bump those guys off the polls. Now, you know they're not the same as me. You know I don't go to other states to cast a second ballot or an absentee ballot. But that is the farce that is being presented. And what Greg Palast has shown is that the Republican operatives led by Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, with funding from the Koch brothers and from the vulture capitalist Paul Singer, that they are working very hard to disenfranchise over a million people, and many of those are in critical battleground states. And this is one of the reasons why I don't spend a lot of time talking about polls, because I don't think polls can measure the intentions of people who go to the polls to vote and then are denied that opportunity, or they're handed a provisional ballot or some other instrument that may never be counted. And so we're hearing a lot of people, including John Husted, who is the Secretary of State of Ohio, who, according to Greg Palast, has already purged his own group of voters. He's allowed to go on television and radio and say, "No problems. Our election system is perfect. We've never seen..." There was a guy on the Public News Hour who is a Republican. I guess he was head of the Republican Party in Florida in 2000. And they allowed this guy to repeatedly say that there were no illegal efforts at election fraud committed in Florida in 2000. And that went unchallenged by the public television moderators. So it you can tell, I am getting a little worked up here. It drives me crazy when people want to claim that our electoral process has high integrity, and while Trump is wrong about double voters, about people voting dead people's votes, there are significant issues that could cause this election to be manipulated, and based on the track record so far, Trump is actually correct that if there is manipulation of this election, it's probably going to favor the Clinton campaign and not the Republicans. And that is a real shift from recent history going back as far as the year 2000. Now to the latest revelations from the hacked emails. And I want to note that my friend Bill Binney, who was a top dog at the NSA until he left in protest, he has consistently stated as recently as this week that the hack did not come from Russia. And Ed Snowden has weighed in and said that if it came from Russia, the NSA would know. Now, we are still offered absolutely no proof of the assertions that Russia is responsible. Now, putting that aside, one of the most damaging revelations is an exchange of emails between a top official at the State Department named Patrick Kennedy. He's the most senior manager there at Foggy Bottom. And he was going back and forth with FBI officials trying to get them to declassify one particular email related to Benghazi that wound up on Hillary Clinton's private server. And it's inconvenient because it is part of the evidence that shows that she lied repeatedly when she assured the public that there was never any classified information sent or received on her private email system. So what's going on here is Kennedy, who is described by some unhappy FBI agents as the heavy who kept pressuring them to declassify these emails to reduce Clinton's embarrassment and contradiction, that there also was an offer of a quid pro quo. You scrub this email of classified markings, and the State Department will approve a request by the FBI to increase the headcount, the number of FBI agents, on duty in Iraq. Now, I'm not sure why the FBI wanted to send more people to Iraq, but apparently this was on their agenda, and this guy, Patrick Kennedy, appears to offer what some people say could be a quid pro quo. If you do me this favor, we'll do you that favor. Now, we're told, of course, there was no quid pro quo, and that it just happened that on a conversation about the emails before they hung up, they said, hey, by the way, what about the staffing quota in Iraq? Well, you can put whatever spin on it you want. And it is fair to say that when you look at your own emails a year or two later, you may not be able to decipher the actual intent or underlying motives. So I'm not jumping to conclusions here. I'm not saying that this is smoking gun or solid evidence. It is just more embarrassment, and it shows that the FBI did not pursue these significant issues before James Comey, right after the 4th of July, said Hillary is, she was careless with her emails, but we're not going to pursue any indictments. More coverage related to an internal discussion thread of Clinton campaign top people related to their policy about taking money from Americans who lobby on behalf of foreign governments. These are people who are called registered foreign agents, and they are permitted to donate to campaigns. I don't think they should be. But, for example, Tony Podesta, who is the brother of Clinton campaign co-chair John Podesta, he runs his own lobby shop, and the nations of Iraq, Azerbaijan, and Egypt are his clients, and so is Saudi Arabia. And it's an open question whether a donation from Tony Podesta was reimbursed by the Saudis or by Iraq or Azerbaijan or the military dictator in Egypt, or whether out of the goodness of his heart he made a contribution to the Clinton campaign from the profits that he derived, his own income from those foreign governments, dictatorships that he represents. So it would be cleaner for the Clinton campaign to say, hey, you know, let's take the high road. When they go low, we go, oh, no, not this time, because there's cash involved. There's money on the table. And so when you hear about the discussion going on in the campaign, they go back and forth, and there's this the lawyer for the campaign, Mark Elias, says, well, you know, if somebody represents Alberta, Canada, can't give, but a lobbyist for Philip Morris can, then I think we should just do this on a case-by-case basis, not a flat-out ban. Then Robbie Mook, the campaign manager, says that, you know, the attorney made a convincing case to me, and he convinced me. So in a complete U-turn, I'm okay just taking the money and dealing with any attacks. Are you guys okay with that? And then Jennifer Palmieri, the campaign's communications director, who I met a few times years back, she replied in the email simply, take the money, exclamation point. So again, there isn't a crime being committed here, but it shows that when it comes to ethics and taking that proverbial high road, the Clinton campaign is allergic to it. Also, we are learning that there is close coordination, which is a violation of law, between the Clinton campaign and the super PACs that are aligned with it. And I want to credit Lee Fung at The Intercept for diving into the emails and ferreting out the references I'm about to make. And I did link to the article at The Intercept, so you can read this because there's more detail than I'll cover. But for example, in a July memo last year addressed to Clinton herself, the campaign laid out plans for working with the Democratic National Committee, David Brock's Super PAC Correct the Record, and one section of the memo instructed work with CTR and DNC to publicize specific GOP candidate vulnerabilities. Now, I've worked on campaigns, and the lawyers who advised me have always just burned it in that you cannot coordinate with the campaign when you're running a super PAC or an independent expenditure. And I've run both. And I have observed not only the spirit, but the letter of the law. I had a case with a local independent expenditure campaign where the candidate himself was making communications that violate the separation. And that was very uncomfortable, but he didn't communicate to me, and I didn't communicate with him. It was with other parties. So I'm aware that it goes on, and I'm also aware that these rules are not enforced. The Federal Election Commission is completely deadlocked with an equal number of Democrats and Republicans, and so there is no enforcement of these rules. But here's another example where in October of last year, several Clinton staffers were strategizing over ways to attack an author who they claimed attributed a fake quote to former President Clinton in a book. And the email says, I'm sure that Brock and team would love to go at him. Nick, want me to put you in touch with them? That's referring to Nick Merrill, the press secretary. And so this shows that they are very comfortable and cozy with brazenly violating the rules of separation between the campaign and its allied super PACs. I want to recommend to you a digest of these revealed emails that Kevin Gostola has compiled over at Shadowproof. And it's linked in the show file for today's podcast, broken down by category: Wall Street, healthcare, labor and trade, energy and climate change, LGBT, foreign policy, the Democratic primary, the private email account. And I won't go through each line item here, but I recommend if you are curious about what is really in these emails and want to know more about it, click on that link and absorb that information. And I'll note that the limited coverage that the Clinton email hack has gotten are generally very breezy kind of process or gotcha emails, but they never delve into the very serious consequences that I think the media should be pursuing. And they kind of, you know, say, well, these could have come from the Russians, so we can't take these seriously. But Glenn Greenwald wrote a great piece, and I'm not linking to it, but you can find it at The Intercept, where he makes the case that good journalists publish leaks, no matter where they came from or how they got to them. And we're seeing a lot of games played by the corporate media to minimize the impact on the Clinton campaign at this stage. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And I just look at the latest PayPal list of people whose contributions have been posted. And today, Nick Yaksich is at the top of the list, followed by Bob Donjakour. And I mentioned Bob yesterday at the outset of the podcast. He remains in intensive care in a hospital in San Francisco after a serious accident last week where he was essentially run over on his bicycle. And Bob has been a stalwart and very generous supporter of this podcast, and we're sending him the very best wishes. And as soon as he is able, I hope to visit him in the hospital. And also, I want to thank Carla Mahoney, who reached out with a little sympathy for me and expressed that by taking out a second subscription to the Peter B. Collins podcast. You people, you're really, really solid, and I appreciate that. If you're not a subscriber, it's easy to change that. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click menu, pull down, click become a subscriber. You go to the sign-up page, and it's very easy from there. Well, the NSLs that the FBI issues, authorized by the Patriot Act, don't get much attention because these so-called national security letters are the equivalent of search warrants, but they come with a built-in gag order, and the people who receive an NSL are not permitted to reveal that they have received it or what they have done in response to it. So we have a curious situation here where yesterday the FBI released Google from the gag order associated with a national security letter that was issued in the first half of 2015. This was revealed on a blog that Google maintains called Building on Surveillance Reform. Now, what is curious is that Google announced that the gag order has been lifted, but it offered no details now that it is free to share them. They say that they will ultimately reveal that information, but so far, all we know is that the government has authorized them to do so, but they haven't. A really troubling development here in San Francisco at the campus of San Francisco State University. I've tangled with David Horowitz before. He is a really ugly individual, and he is a very aggressive Zionist. He is the author of what I would call pro-Semitic hate propaganda. And I use that phrase, with some caution, but because we always hear about anti-Semitic expressions and that people who are politically opposed to the government of Israel, who are correctly labeled, like me, anti-Zionists, are simply by the calculation of a guy like David Horowitz, automatically anti-Zionist. So last Friday, with no authorization, the group that Horowitz runs, which, let me get the name of it, the David Horowitz Freedom Center, basically trespassed on campus and without any permission, posted a series of posters attacking a professor at San Francisco State named Rabab Abdul Hadi. It claims that she is a leader of the Hamas BDS campaign, that she collaborates with terrorists, that she's a professor, the last part is true, and then they use the hashtag JewHatred. Now, this professor has been attacked by Zionists before, and quoted by the San Francisco Chronicle, the professor of ethnic studies said, "Obviously, it's really devastating to be accused of things you have no relationship with. This is very racist. It is Islamophobic." Now, she's a faculty advisor for the school's General Union of Palestinian Students, a group advocating Palestinian liberation. And she said, "They're really trying to silence us. More and more people in the United States are recognizing the question of justice for the Palestinian community." Now, here's what's crucial. The posters accuse her of being a leader of the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Aimed at Israel. That's a movement that I support and participate in. And David Horowitz then, by attribution or by association, says, well, then you're supporting Hamas. That is flatly untrue. I am opposing Israel. I am not supporting Hamas or any other alleged terrorist group. And this faulty logic is permitted to be expressed and is often embraced by non-Jews in power, in positions of power. And this is a very creeping, serious problem in this country. And I want to make you aware of it. I have linked to the San Francisco Chronicle's report about this incident in the show file for today's podcast. How about some good news? I know it's in short supply. It was over a year ago that the attorneys for the Center for Constitutional Rights negotiated a settlement with the State of California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. This was aimed at sharply reducing, if not eliminating, the use of long-term solitary confinement. And the good news is that in the past year, the number of California prisoners in long-term indefinite solitary confinement has been reduced by 99%. Can you believe that? I can't. Last year, there were 1,557 prisoners in solitary. 1,532 of those have been completely transferred out of solitary. And at Pelican Bay, the Supermax prison on the north coast of California near Crescent City, the solitary population has dropped from 513 to 5. That is music to my ears. Now, we're seeing acknowledgement of some of the deep flaws in the Affordable Care Act, dubbed Obamacare, and the people who run healthcare.gov have announced that they are responding. They're going to fix what I consider to be a major defect in the insurance plans that are offered. And they're going to start offering standardized plans that cover standardized health plans that cover basic services with a zero deductible. And as you know, the elements in a health insurance policy include the amount of the premium you pay, the total amount of coverage that you're buying, and the trigger points of when the coverage actually kicks in. That's the deductible. And a high deductible policy means that you bear the burden of the amounts below the deductible that is indicated in the policy that you buy. And so people have been paying higher premium rates for coverage with high deductibles, meaning that they pay more for health insurance that they don't get to use very much unless they have a very serious medical event. So this is good news, but they're not telling us the rates, the premiums that will be charged for these zero deductible policies. And so I can't get excited about this at this point, because it is the right move. It does address a major flaw in Obamacare. But until we know the premium rates, we really can't tell whether this is an actual improvement. And we've seen the announced rate increases for the state of California for 2017. Statewide, the premium rates will go up by an average of 13.2%. And it's broken out by county. The highest increase in the Northern California region affects San Francisco, where the increase is just 0.2% under 15% increase over the current rates. And they've been running increases of 4-9% over the last 3 years. So this is a spike, and it is going to, I think, put more pressure to push for single payer and some significant reforms of Obamacare in the interim. I want to acknowledge some emails from listeners, including Jason Ferguson, who writes, "Can you spend a couple of minutes to talk about the Electoral College before the election? My basic understanding is that the Electoral College almost always votes in line with the popular vote." Well, that's not exactly true, Jason. And his issue is that he wants to vote third party, but he wants to make sure that it doesn't have, unexpected repercussions via the Electoral College. And let me lay it out simply. There are a handful of states where the Electoral College numbers and who they are assigned to vote for are determined by a congressional district. But in over 45 of the states, it is winner take all. If Donald Trump wins California, he gets all 53 Electoral College votes. If Hillary Clinton wins, she gets all 53. And so in many respects, the popular vote is not that relevant because it's an interesting barometer of how people voted. But what really matters is the ultimate vote of the Electoral College. And so it is an arcane system. Jason writes, I'm not trying to advocate either for or against it, but I will. I'm against the Electoral College. I think it should be thrown out of the Constitution. That takes a constitutional amendment. But some clever lawyers have worked up a strategy where if we could get all states to agree that they will deliver the Electoral College vote to the top vote getter, the winner of the popular vote, there's some other elements to it that I can't think of right now. But there is a way to get all of the states to agree to operate in a way that would essentially make the Electoral College irrelevant. And I would support that if we can ever reach a point of consensus. And I want to acknowledge an email that came in all the way from Saudi Arabia, where an American expatriate works, and we're going to call him Boutros. Boutros is the Arabic name for Peter. And his name is not Peter, but he doesn't want to be identified explicitly. He said, I listened to your Medea Benjamin interview about her book about the Saudis. I was expecting her to get a lot wrong about Saudi Arabia, but was pleasantly surprised. She gets it exactly right as far as what I see and experience here. To add a little more color, I know some young Saudi women fairly well, and am acquaintances with many more. Of the ones I know well, one has been totally supported by her family in pursuing her education and career. She has a master's in engineering, worked for a global electronics manufacturer. Two of her sisters have PhDs and others a dentist. Her father told them he wants them to have a profession, so if they end up in a bad marriage, they can divorce the guy and support themselves. Another young Saudi woman has a very backward-thinking, difficult father, but has pushed her way through sheer persistence to get an engineering degree and a job at an oil field service company where she's been recognized by the CEO and already in 3 years has been given an important position. By the way, she was among the first Saudi women to work at that company. The third is a woman whose father owns a lucrative retail business which she now owns and runs. She married a second husband years ago who slammed her head into the wall so hard after she talked back to him that she got a concussion. It happened several times, and in spite of her economic standing, she had no recourse. So the thing here is a woman's life is prescribed by her family. If her family is good, she has a good life. If it's bad, she has no recourse and is basically a prisoner. That's what I see. And by the way, in the last year or two, women are getting jobs at the checkout counter, at the grocery store, in the malls, etc. This is new. Things are opening up, and there are Saudis that want change. It is really in internal war. Thanks, Boutros. I appreciate that input from way over in Saudi Arabia. And I know we have more international listeners now accessing the podcast every day on YouTube. So wherever you listen, I'm glad you've checked in. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.